Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and Anne Guests.
Welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. This is episode 174. I'm Paul Spain.
And my name's Ed Hyde.
Welcome along, Ed.
Thank you very much.
Very nice to have you here.
Good. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Now, tell us where you fit into the technology and telecommunications ecosystem in New Zealand.
Sure. So I work for Telecom Digital Ventures, the new growth business unit as part of Telecom New Zealand, or as we're going to be called fairly shortly, Spark. And I look after half a dozen of their small growth businesses.
Great. So what are those units that you've been involved in so far?
So I look after Skinny, the Wi-Fi business, our joint venture initiative between Vodafone, 2Degrees and Paymark around m-commerce and mobile payments. We've launched the new business Curious, which is around big data, and we're working on some stuff in the application space as well.
Excellent. Great. Well, we'll dive in and have a bit more of a chat about that further along. But let's jump straight into the news. Now, we've had this week the announcement or the launch of Google Now, which has been available on Android smartphones for some time, but that's now available on the Chrome browser through Windows and Mac. Now, are you a Chrome user at all there, Ed?
I'm a Chrome user on my laptop. Yep. A Google Android user, Samsung S4 user on my device. So I've been using Google Now for a while, actually, on the device.
And what do you find it's most useful for?
I think probably the most useful things is just the basics around weather, traffic, you know, time to your next meeting. I do get the soccer results coming through, but that's about it, really.
And is it linked up to your email, so it's reading your emails and telling you about your flights and things like that?
It is. It's not that accurate. It doesn't seem to fully integrate. I think I was in San Francisco about probably September, October last year, and it funnily enough, it was a lot more accurate over there than it is here. So
yeah, funny that, isn't it? When it's in their hometown,
exactly.
A lot of things light up. I mean, that seems to be the case across, you know, other services as well. Not just Google's, but Apple and Microsoft. Once you're in their part of the world, they seem to do a little bit better.
You've got to win in your hometown, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they seem to do that. Now you're a Mac user. We've just heard that the rumors are rife that Apple's going to be launching a 12-inch MacBook, a fanless new MacBook. Would that be of interest to you, or do you like the bigger screen?
Prefer the bigger screen personally. I use an iPad as well. So for me, just having a difference in screen size between the tablet and the laptop makes sense. I can't see myself sort of trading down in screen size, really.
Yeah, fair enough. It's interesting, isn't it? We've got all these different form factors now, and you tend to find what are the things that work well for you. I use tablets more and more in certain environments, but sitting doing a podcast, it's pretty unusual not to find me with a laptop sort of resting on my knee. So there's places for all sorts of gadgets, but when it does come to laptops, I quite like the smaller screen, usually, because you end up with a smaller, lighter device for when you're traveling and so on. But the nice thing is there are plenty of options. Now, we're also hearing some rumors about HP that they're moving towards the launch of their first 3D printer. Does this make sense to you that HP should be moving into that market? Do you think there's a lot of money to be made in 3D printing?
I think so. I think it's going to be huge. As part of work, we're not doing a great deal in this space, but personally, I'm very interested about how things are going to play out. I think the whole piece around IP protection is going to be really interesting. You know, all of these proprietary designs from, you know, genuinely world-leading designers around the world, all of a sudden what happens? Can you copy those? Can someone be printing them out the other side of the world or whatever? So I think that's going to be very interesting. I was also visiting the BizDojo guys on K Road a few months ago, and they've got a 3D printer down there, and they've got some whizzy guys there running some very sort of interesting models off of the 3D printer, and still very early days, still very basic, but I think you can just see actually the development in that space moving forward massively. It wouldn't surprise me in 5 years' time that actually there's a bunch of households with 3D printers at home.
Yeah, I think it's certainly becoming more mainstream. I think the Auckland Public Library have got one, so it's, you know, it's not, you know, out of reach to use one. Certainly, their prices have sort of come down to the point where people can, you know, people can afford to have them in their home. But I think it's still early days in terms of the development of them and what you can achieve with them. I did see something that was quite cool the other day. It was a video of the world's first 3D printed kayak.
Really?
And the chap had he had sort of custom built a slightly bigger 3D printer than was the norm, and he put the kayak together out of I can't remember how many pieces, but it was probably somewhere between 15 and 30 wow. Sections that he built, and then they were done in such a way they could be bolted together. And then he put some sort of waterproofing sort of sealant around the joins, and
away you go.
And away you go. And yeah, there was a video of him, paddling down a river on his multicolored kayak. It was really cool because each section was different, nice bright shades. So
I can't remember who it was I was talking to, but they were sort of talking about how, you know, 3D printers could really sort of gain scale, and that households would have, you know, printers, you know, similar to the way the sort of microwaves took off. But then thinking about how you might go down to the local petrol station and they have a large scale 3D printer if you want to print something larger, you know, out sort of the mind boggles really about how things could change.
Well, I mean, it does, and you think, as you talked about, you know, various designs and certain, you know, objects, you can pay, you know, a lot of money to get something that you really like the design of, but if those things will ultimately, as you're suggesting, sort of end up online in such a way that you could print out a cool new design or something or other yourself, it's... It's going to be it's going to be interesting to see what business is built around the technologies, but also what the impact is, as we've seen an impact on probably on music more than anything in terms of the way that that's, you know, distributed electronically now, and you know, artists who have changed how they make their money in music is much more now around doing the live shows and so on,
exactly,
rather than around actually, you know, selling CDs at their shows or you know, selling physical media as they did in the past.
Exactly. The other thing that's really exciting from my perspective is all of a sudden it levels the playing fields around scale efficiencies. You know, so, you know, the cost of producing a small limited run of maybe, you know, half a dozen or a dozen units, you know, all of a sudden that the cost of actually doing that comes down significantly, and, you know, so that will really you know, promote small creative entities working at small scale but actually producing some really interesting stuff. You know, and I think good for New Zealand. You know, if you sort of think about competing with large scale production facilities in Asia or the States or whatever, actually that starts to become less of an issue in certain areas.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it is quite exciting from that perspective. I was talking to my brother recently, and he works in a New Zealand business that's expanding globally. They're called Clip and Climb. They've got a climbing wall in Auckland, but they've got them all around the world, and, you know, they've created some quite innovative technology and designs, and the concept is now in UK and Europe and Canada and Asia and so on, and they rely quite heavily now on a, you know, 3D, I'm not sure if it's a 3D printer, I think it's more a machine that sort of cuts down metal. I've forgotten the term for that type of machine,
computer-aided design or the I can't think of the word.
But you know, effectively, getting a similar type of result, and you know, that's been a really essential tool in what they do, And yeah, you're certainly right in terms of not having to fire stuff off to big manufacturing countries, and mm-hmm. especially for doing small run and prototypes, there's exactly. all sorts of opportunities. Yeah. So yeah, that's exciting. Now, 2 Degrees. They are. We hear that they're about to kick off trials of an LTE network, a 4G network. Mm-hmm. So that will once they launch, that means I guess all our networks here in New Zealand are in the 4G world. Now I guess it's going to take them a little while to to get that rolled out, and lots of competition between you guys at Telecom and the guys at Vodafone over the last year in terms of getting your networks out there
Exactly, and a subject dear to my heart. My previous role before this one was heading up mobile product for Telecom. So the 4G upgrade was one of my babies.
Cool. Well, so I mean, I'm just curious, how do you use 4G? How do you take advantage of it now that it's here? It's becoming more and more accessible. Certainly, here in Auckland, the coverage has been very, very good. Actually, I mean, my experience when I was last sort of doing a comparison a few months ago was, you probably had the better coverage around Auckland at that stage. I think Vodafone had pushed out to some other locations to sort of, nationally give them a bit more. How are you using it sort of day to day? Has it changed much for you?
Oh, look,
compared to where we were with 3G, that extra speed boost?
I think it has. I mean, I'm a bit geeky in that respect, that I'm still regularly doing speed tests and seeing the scores that come through. I'm sort of pleased to say I'm still experiencing some very, very high speeds. I'm just getting over 100 meg in my front living room, which is unbelievable, really, and far faster than VDSL. But
are you sitting under a cell tower?
I've got line of sight to a cell tower.
Yeah, I think that's pretty impressive to have that on a regular basis.
Yeah, I think it's about 400 or 500 meters away. So it's under a good situation, but it's blazingly quick. But in terms of how that translates day to day, I think the usability now, things are just more instant. I've noticed myself using tethering more for my laptop. Just because the speed is so much faster when I'm doing work and needing to sort of shift high volumes of emails and looking at files and so on and so forth. But I think I was in Europe a couple of weeks ago and not on 4G. And actually, that was the biggest marker for me, which was actually no longer having the service and going, actually, this is a bit slow.
And also, what I've found when I'm roaming with 3G is it just seems that 3G isn't as fast in some parts of the world as what it is around New Zealand. So it's you sort of got that double whammy. Not only have you been bumped down to 3G when you're roaming, you've been bumped down to a really poor version of 3G. I think we're a little bit spoilt, maybe partly because of our population size. I mean, you'd know this actually. Could probably tell me much better why there's that variance. Yeah, but I tend to notice that when I'm roaming. Is that the same for you?
I think the sort of first point from my perspective is not all 3G mobile networks or 4G mobile networks, LTE networks for that matter, are created equally. There's a huge variation, which is largely dependent on how much sort of capital infrastructure is put in, and also the amount of load that's on the network. If I think about my experiences around the world, Europe by and large tends to be pretty slow. 4G is available, 3G is available, but actually, the quality of that service is poor. They tend to have less cell sites per head of population, less backhaul, so the amount of traffic is choked coming back through the network, so everything slows down. The sort of reverse, though, if you think about China and Korea, blazingly quick. San Francisco, back to the you know, back to some of the sort of tech companies, San Francisco is absolutely flying in terms of the speed. But we perform pretty well when you're looking at that company. I think the jump for us from 3G to 4G as a nation was actually smaller than in some other countries, primarily because 3G was performing so well.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, we often like to sort of pick on, you know, the providers around the things that that we don't like, but it's not often we recognise we're actually doing all right.
Exactly, and I take a lot of pride in the mobile networks that we built. We put a lot of time and effort behind it all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I often hear from people saying, "Oh, this, you know, the ultra fast broadband rollout's taking too long," and I just usually sort of point my finger over at Australia and ask people to have a look at how well they're they're getting on. And you've got to step back a little bit sometimes. Now, just in terms of the update on 2degrees for listeners, so what they're saying is that they're going to begin a 4G trial on April 1st. And I don't think that's any kind of April Fool's joke. That's the real story. And then they're going to make it public for customers in Central Auckland in July. So yeah, it's going to take them some time to roll out. They're saying that their 4G sites in Auckland will triple will roll out to sort of the wider region by the end of the year, and then availability in Hamilton, Wellington, and Christchurch is also by the end of the year. So it's going to take them a while to sort of ramp this stuff up. But I think, you know, it's fair to say that 2degrees probably have to be a little bit cautious. Their revenues aren't at the same sort of level as as Telecom and Vodafone, the way they're doing it is going to be somewhat more lower cost to probably achieve. And yeah, exactly. They've made differences as well.
I think the investment that they're making is more measured. I think, by and large, their customer base will have a slightly different set of demands on the network, and it makes sense to actually, you know, delay the investment, but, you know, 12 to 18 months behind ourselves and Vodafone. And I think it's more a case of economics, really. You know, you have to make sure that the customer demand is there, otherwise it doesn't make sense to do the build.
Yeah, there's also... there's a level of, you buy new technology on day one, it's always going to be a little bit more expensive than it is 6 months, 12 months, 18, 24 months down the track, right?
Exactly.
As it becomes more mainstream. And I mean, you'd certainly know those economics a lot better than I would, but I imagine that gives them some good savings overall.
Exactly.
Now, interestingly, Microsoft are... they've been pretty reasonable about making their products in recent times sort of available across multiple platforms, and they've moved away from being the guys that just had Windows and Mac apps, and their SkyDrive and Bing and Office and so on have been reasonably broad in terms of their platforms. But one area that they haven't had Office on has been on tablets other than on the Microsoft Surface.
Yep. Yep.
And the rumor a few days ago has that the Microsoft are very close to launching Office for the iPad. Is that something you'd use?
I think it is for certain Office products, yeah. Mm. I still haven't found a better alternative to spreadsheets and Excel.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so when you're looking at numbers, that absolutely is my preference. Word is still a very good, Word product. I don't know a better way to describe it. So I think it makes sense. I think it's a reflection of where the world's going and where the devices that consumers are using and the devices that consumers want to use those products and services. So I think it makes sense. It would have, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the interesting news that sort of came, well, shortly after those rumors sort of started landing, Microsoft have invited some of the media in the US to an event with their new CEO, Satya Nadella, and they're saying this is what he's going to do, and the impact was that Microsoft shares promptly went up by 5% or so, and they're now at probably the highest they've been sort of since the dot-com boom of late 90s, early 2000s. I think certainly the highest they've been in probably 13 or 14 years. So an interesting bit of a resurgence for Microsoft.
Quiet
there.
Quiet performers, really. I was looking actually in the sort of the announcements in January, the record-breaking revenues for the company. So whilst they're having challenges in certain areas of their core markets, they're also clearly doing well in others. Particularly in gaming and cloud, they're moving on.
Yeah, well, interestingly, the Xbox there, which we shared some figures last year that we came across through some of New Zealand's retailers around. Pre-orders for the Xbox, and the Xbox getting it was 5-1 in favor of the PlayStation 4 at one stage against the Xbox One, but a lot of those numbers have actually improved a lot for Microsoft internationally, and I think it was the February figures that were announced recently. And the Xbox was getting very, very close to the PlayStation 4 numbers. So, yeah, I don't think Microsoft are doing too bad. And across the business, I think they're generating some pretty strong profits. They haven't sort of come back to the they don't seem to have the same cool factor associated with them as Microsoft or Google. But if they keep sort of pushing things and keep coming up with interesting products, then I guess all that's got to help their profile.
Exactly, and I think a good example of how they are, they're changing as a business. Their revenue composition. I don't know the exact figures, but it must have changed hugely if you rewind versus 10 years ago. Much more game centric. Much less focused around the sort of ongoing revenue streams around the sort of software licenses, OS licenses, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, there's a pretty big mix there. I mean, they make a lot on their sort of the business and enterprise class sort of products. They still make huge numbers on Windows by sheer volumes and Office. These are all sort of multi-billion-dollar businesses for them. They're always trying to certainly reinvent and stay up with the play, and all the right signs are there in some areas, but I know there's plenty that think Microsoft's day is done and they're over, but certainly the profits aren't sort of suggesting that at the moment. So now, talking of money, Kim.com. He's been in the media somewhat over the last few days. Now, first up, the app for his internet party, which he's launched, has been approved by Apple, and this is going to allow people to jump on board with his political party and sign up as members via an app, which is interesting. The first time this has been done in New Zealand, and there was a piece in the Herald saying that Peter Dunn wasn't too pleased, because when his party had issues with not having enough members, they were advised that they couldn't sign people up online. Mm. What do you think about this? It must be good bringing things forward into a bit more of a digital era.
I think by and large it's great news. I think the sort of digitization of politics and voting can only be a good thing. With participation in electoral voting being so low, particularly around the sort of younger audience, I think this is great. Anything that can make it more usable, is a good thing. I think the timing might be a little bit unfortunate. I can feel for Peter Dunn. given it wasn't too long ago, but things have to move on, things have to change sometime.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the one of the other things that Doc.com's been in the media for is that Orcon is saying they're wrapping up their Kim.com campaign. They're saying it was extremely successful for them in generating new business, so that they were, I think, getting 70% more sign-ups for internet connections while that was on compared to normal for them. But they're taking his mug off the TV screens and citing really them getting into sort of potentially some legal hot water with flashing his photo around while he's launching a political party and the potential to sort of run foul of the Electoral Commission. Okay. There does that make much sense to you? Does that sound
I don't begin to understand politics in great detail and what sort of oversteps the mark, but interesting. I've seen a lot of the Orcon advertising over the past 2 or 3 weeks, and it's certainly got a sort of character and a sense of humour that's sort of quite refreshing in the marketplace. I do think there's probably a real blurring of the boundaries between what is business, what is advertising, and what is politics that probably does need to be resolved. So, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's certainly the profile's there now, isn't it? And there's plenty of stories of the past of people with high profiles, in various ways, whether movie stars or otherwise, that have landed themselves in very good positions in politics. So, at this stage, Kim.com's not putting himself forward, and isn't in a position to get into Parliament himself. But who knows? Jump forward 20 years, and it might be Prime Minister Kim.com and the Internet Party that are running New Zealand.
There's an interesting thought.
So we'll wait and see. I'm quite fascinated to see how this progresses.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And there is a potential to sort of draw in maybe a an audience of younger or disenfranchised voters that maybe a bit more excited about voting with the Internet Party coming through. So we'll certainly continue to watch one.
I dare say there'll be a few twists and turns before it's all done.
Oh yeah, I would think there'll be a twist and turn or two, to be sure.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, he really is all over the media this week, and actually today, all of the big international media outlets have picked up the story. I'm just looking at a Bloomberg article here, but when I went through on Google News, the story of Mega launching on the stock exchange here in New Zealand was all over the place. In fact, here it says that there are 73 news sources on this particular article. Business Week, Financial Times. We got the Southland Times thrown in there, as well as Reuters and Radio New Zealand, Reuters India. Really all over the media,
and your podcast
and the InterTech podcast. So so really the .com, you've hit the big time this week. But all about the fact that they've landed themselves on the on the stock exchange. So quite an interesting tale. Reading from Bloomberg.com, it says that Mega will and this Mega Limited will buy out the listed shell company TRS Investments Limited in what's being called a reverse takeover, a deal which will value Mega at $210 million New Zealand dollars, the company said today. So highlights that Kim.com himself resigned as the director of Mega last August. to concentrate on fighting his extradition, but his wife Mona owns 26.5% of the company, and there are various sort of breakdowns from there that you can read about online. Now, why do you think he's gone through this process to get listed? I mean, this seems like an interesting way to do it. I would have thought, yeah, maybe there would have been enough public interest for him to do a more traditional route in terms of initial public offering. Is this a way of sort of lowering the risk? And do you think he's maybe somewhat, or the mega, file sharing, file storage service is somewhat safer being a publicly listed company than being one that's private and more closely maybe tied back to his family?
Well, I it's difficult to say actually without much detail. I guess any listing sort of introduces an extra level of sort of governance and controls and obligations as a business, you know, as a byproduct of being listed. So I guess that's a step up. As to why a backdoor entry versus, you know, a more traditional listing, I couldn't possibly comment.
I mean, it's certainly it's a quick way to get into that sort of position. Noting the legal pressures that have been on .com for some time, and particularly on Mega Upload. Yeah, I'm quite curious in terms of, and I'm sure there must be, this is more than just financial, my first guess of it anyway. Mm. I would think there will be some sort of legal reasons why it makes sense also for this to be a public company, but I guess time will tell us a little bit more on that picture.
I think so.
I guess that the thing is, wherever .com goes, there are waves of one form or another. So this isn't the last.
Certainly getting plenty of coverage at the moment
that we've heard of him. Now, a story I'm a little more excited about than that listing is Uber. Now, we've spoken on the podcast before about Uber, San Francisco company. Them and a number of others are in the business of reinventing what a taxi is. And they've done a sort of a soft launch of sorts into the Auckland market with what they call the stage they call it is Uber Secret. So they're not out heavily sort of publicising themselves. But if we look at what they've done in other markets such as Sydney and elsewhere around the world, at some stage they will get out and really blow their trumpet that they're here, and they'll be sponsoring all sorts of different things, and you'll hear about them probably everywhere.
Absolutely.
But for now, you'll mostly be hearing about them through social media and the likes of the NZ Tech podcast. So let me fill you in if you're not for those that aren't familiar. Uber was introduced to me last year actually by one of the chaps who's been on the podcast before, Steve Sims, when I was in San Francisco last year, and he showed me the app, and it's very, very cool. The way that it works is you book your ride directly via the app, and when you fire up the app, you can see where the various cars are that might be nearby to you, so you've got a handle on, you know, how soon somebody will be able to pick you up. You can get an estimate of what the fare will be. So if you're in a different city, that's pretty handy. And I guess one of the uniques about Uber for me is, and I know have you used Uber before? Is it one of the other ones?
I've used Uber and Sidecar in San Francisco.
Sidecar, right? Yeah. So one of the things is when you're traveling, you don't necessarily you know the number for the local cab company. So the concept of one company that's actually, or a few of these types of companies that are actually really widespread around the world, I think is certainly great for travellers. I remember when I used to do a lot of travelling, and I'd be, you know, back and forth with various cities, I'd be always capturing the various taxi numbers and putting them in my contacts. But with Uber, which I think they're saying is now in 33 countries, you don't have to do that now. So the app's quite good in terms of, you know, finding what's nearby you in terms of cars. You don't have to get out or go and call a cab. The next bit that is nice is that once you've made that booking, you can actually see where the car is that's coming to pick you up. So you know how far it is. You know when to. You know, you can, if it's raining or something, you can actually stay inside until the car's sort of close at hand, rather than going, you know, standing in the rain or standing, you know, outside if it's too hot, whatever. And you get a picture of who's going to pick you up. You get their name, what their rating is, because you get to rate each driver after the journey. And you've got that opportunity to contact them, and they can also contact you if there's some issue at their end. So I had this the other day. I was getting picked up in Auckland at St. Luke's, and I could see the cab driver was nearby. And because it's a big mall area, I thought, well, there's a potential that he doesn't quite know where I am. Yeah. So I just clicked on. I thought, oh, should I send him a text? No, I'll give him a call. And his real mobile number comes up, and I was able to call this guy that I've never interacted with before, but I knew his name, and his number was there, and it was great just being able to do that. And he said, oh, just, you know, wait such and such. I said, yep, that's where I am. And, 20 seconds later, he pulled up, opened the door, and I jumped in. And, a really good experience. And when I got out at the other end, he obviously pushed something on his phone to say that the journey had ended. He had an opportunity to sort of give me a rating. And as I walked up my driveway, the app gave me an option of rating him. It showed how much the fare had cost. I hadn't had to transact any money sort of physically, so I was able just to, you know, get out and get going. And, it just deducted that off my account. A really smooth, really smooth experience. So, I think it's definitely a step forward from the old traditional taxi ride, and I guess it's just another industry that's being reinvented with technology.
I agree. The favorite thing for me actually around the whole thing was that the sort of social aspect of being able to rate the experience. You know, we've all had good taxi experiences and bad taxi experiences, and the ability to actually in some way filter for good experiences I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, it is, and I mean, just also that little sort of the personal aspect, and you know, knowing who your driver is, and you haven't called and given your name or anything, but you walk in and you're greeted by name and so on, those sort of extra aspects that they can bring using the app is really good. What I'm curious about is how this is actually going to transform, you know, this industry. And I guess for me, one of the standouts is the fact that I can have an app that I can actually use all over the world.
Yeah.
And there's certainly in, I think, at least two cities, maybe more, in Australia now, and certainly in San Francisco. So a lot of the places I travel to, they're there already. There are, quite a big list of cities already across Asia, in the Asia Pacific region, as well as Australia, China, India, Korea, Japan, Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand, and Taiwan. Now they're not in all of the cities, obviously, but they are getting started. So for me, I can see that being something that gives them a whole lot of a one step up above the competition, just that they're in all those locations. But we've got an existing industry here, and lots of people that are employed by our existing taxi firms.
Yeah.
And, we have seen them coming up with apps, and there are other things happening in that space. But, you know, they've got extra regulations and sort of layers around how they operate. How do you think that's going to transform? Any pick on that?
Oh, it's an interesting question. I think at a macro level, anything that can be done to actually improve the customer experience and the efficiency of taking taxi rides is a good thing. I think it would only encourage more taxi rides to take place, and therefore more drivers are required, you know, over a period of time. So from my perspective, I'm not sure it, you know, worrying about that market and the number of drivers declining wouldn't be at the top of my list. I think having said that, though, different standards around regulation and safety and all the rest of it, you know, from relative for traditional taxi companies relative to these new entrants, I don't think that's fair if actually there is materially disadvantaging the traditional taxi services. So I think that has to be kept in check. You can't allow new services to come in that aren't safe or have an uneven playing field. I think there's
some issues there at the moment, aren't there? And I know, I think it was Japan recently where I think one of the Uber drivers was attacked, or you know, his vehicle was damaged and so on, because some of the taxi drivers were upset about what was happening there. So at the moment they're certainly taking advantage of probably a few loopholes to get in and accelerate their position before some of those things close up. And there are some cities, certainly in the US and elsewhere, where Uber just isn't allowed. And Las Vegas was one of those for me recently, being there and finding, oh, there's no Uber, and you look at the Twitter feeds and so on, and everyone, you know, a lot of people are asking for it.
Exactly.
But the rules are such.
I'm an advocate of innovation and an advocate of technology, and I think you can't hold these things back. They might not be successful in their first incarnation, but you know, if they're successful around the world for whatever reason, there's clearly something there, something of value for the customers or in this case the sort of taxi suppliers that represents an improvement over and above what exists today or preceding it. You know, so I love to see all of these things and, you know, progress and evolve and just see how they play out. It's fascinating for me, and it's not without pain, and it's not not without transition, but you know, hopefully the sort of end state, you know, is an improvement over where we've been previously.
Now, one of the things that that a lot of online businesses do is that they have various sort of rewards if you sign up other people, and that can be an incentive both for someone new to try them out and become a customer, and an incentive for an existing customer to sort of spread the word. Uber seem to be doing exactly that, and I'm sure this is costing them a bomb, but it's their way of helping them get out and promote themselves. With sort of person to person recommendations. So what they do is, once you've signed up and used the service, they will give you a code that if you share it with somebody, that person gets a $20 credit to try out the service for free, and the person that shared their code gets $20 back as well on their account. So if anyone wants to try it out, because I've signed up, there will be a link to one of those codes that will help you if you want to try it out, and will help me. So or you can just go up to their main website and try it out if you wish, and you'll probably find there are other codes online as well. So however you want to try it, but we'll put a link up there anyway. All right, well, those were our main news stories for this week. We've also got we've had a lot of the new smartphone announcements in conjunction with Mobile World Congress, and we've talked about and had some hands-on time with the Galaxy S5 from Samsung, Sony's new Xperia Z2. And since those have gone back, I've been using the Android side, my sort of go-to phone in recent weeks. well, last few months actually, the LG G2, which is sort of somewhere in between the previous generation of devices and this new next generation. One company we hadn't heard from is HTC, and apparently in a few hours' time we'll be hearing the announcement on their new HTC One Mate or M8. So if you're interested in keeping up with the very latest, then have a little bit of a look out online, and I'm sure those details will be up there soon. There's already a supposed video leak of that as well, but it's only a few hours away until that one launches. But now, Ed, I'm very keen to hear a little bit more. Now we've got you here pinned down on the show, a little bit more about telecom. Digital Ventures, which is where you sit, and I mean, you've been involved really in a whole bunch of projects, and Digital Ventures seems to be a fairly interesting part of new part of telecom. Can you tell us how Digital Ventures sort of came about and what its purpose is?
Yeah, absolutely. So Digital Ventures, or TDV as we sort of call it internally, really got created in April, May last year. So we've been going about 8 or 9 months or so, and really we were given the mandate to create some new growth for telecom in either traditional sort of markets and product sets where we're underrepresented. So Skinny's a really good example of mobile prepaid, but in a market in Auckland and under 35s where we were underrepresented. So
that is part of the Digital Ventures, because that's been around more than 8 or 9 months, hasn't it?
It has been around more than eight or nine months. Actually, that's a slightly longer story. I was actually involved 2.5 years now, actually, with all of the sort of Skinny strategy work. So
right.
Skinny is actually a good example. It's almost gone full circle. So sort of involved in the very early days, it went off, it got run out of the retail business with some guys there. It came full circle and ended up back within TDV under me. So I've had my baby back for about 6 months or so.
Great.
And then in adjacent markets and thinking about other products, which is where more of the noise is at the moment. We're thinking about actually what are the products and services that are complementary to our traditional fixed and mobile services. OTT video or ShowMe as it was or about to be renamed is a good example of where the access services of fixed broadband, be it fiber or VDSL or ADSL or even mobile, are now getting to the stage where the delivery of video services is absolutely fine and easy, and people are doing it on a daily basis, and it really opens up a new opportunity for media and content in New Zealand, and we're going to be giving it a good old go. We see that there's a great opportunity there.
Just sort of looking at that one. So ShowMe TV or SparkFlix or whatever it's going to end up being called. Now that's sort of been touted as a little bit of a Netflix for New Zealand. And of course, there are some players in the market, QuickFlix and the like, already that have various offerings. What's going to be, just give us a rundown on what ShowMe TV or SparkFlix or whatever it ends up being called is about. And I know that you haven't finished in terms of your announcements, but just a run through on sort of the highlights of what it's about.
So we're keeping a lot of the detail under wraps for another couple of months. But just to sort of repeat, what we've said previously, the business, the OTT video business is about an internet delivered video and content play, both for movies and TV services. We're keeping the content lineup and the price points and all of that detail closely under wraps, and the guys, it's not me who's involved in that, but the guys are working furiously hard in getting everything ready for a launch towards the middle of this year.
I guess one of the things that's been announced is that you're investing $20 million in this. That's for the first year? Is that what that number is
I
about?
I couldn't possibly comment, Paul.
Good, that's sort of public information, though, yes. Isn't it? That's a sort of committed investment?
Yeah.
Was it not clear whether that was over a period of time? I think that was part of the annual financial sort of, you know, results, so they probably would have been talking in a financial year.
I think the reason for the hesitation, I think it was a multi-year investment, but I'm not sure over how many years the $20 million was spread. So,
okay, because that's going to make quite a bit of difference, isn't it? Because the amount of money that that you can invest into content, that's really going to be, you know, a really big key, isn't it, in terms of, you know, getting the great programs that maybe others don't have access to and making those, you know, available on demand. And, you know, at the moment people get hold of content through a whole lot of mediums, but, you know, traditional TV is certainly lessening. But providers like QuickFlix have struggled because maybe they haven't had deep enough pockets to actually get really the best content. But I mean, if you guys have got a lot of, you know, you've got a probably slightly deeper pockets than say QuickFlix, who, you know, they don't have the backing of a telecom sort of behind them, should be able to give you some pretty good content. Is that your
exactly,
expectation?
Exactly. Look, there's not too much I can say about the detail other than. We're very clear that content is absolutely key in the success of the service, and we need to make sure that we've got an absolutely great content lineup.
Right. So you're taking that side of it extremely seriously.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the area that QuickFlix has sort of become, I guess, known for in part is that they put a lot of effort into getting their apps across a whole lot of platforms, so you can flick on your Xbox, your PlayStation, and TVs and so on. There's, you know, a whole broad range of devices that can carry the apps. Is that part of that, you know, that chunk? I think they said out of the 20 million, you know, maybe 15 was content, the other 5 goes to apps and other developments, because you've got developers in-house, haven't you? So that they're probably easier in some ways for you to develop apps than some of the others.
Yeah, look, there's a team in-house developing it. Will be a rolling roadmap of capability, starting with a relatively narrow range of devices that we can serve content to, and just building out over time. So
okay. Well, We'll look forward to more on that in a couple of months. But
watch this space.
It's I think it's of interest to a lot of us, and particularly as faster and better internet connections become more accessible, then that obviously becomes more practical. And now other projects from Digital Ventures. We've chatted about a couple already. What are the other things that Digital Ventures or that you've been involved in?
So the other pieces of work or small businesses that I've been involved in, you know, clearly Skinny, which we've just mentioned, responsible for the Wi-Fi network, which we've been really pleased with how that's gone. We're approaching a thousand access points this year. We've got well over 100,000 regular users of the service. That's growing every month.
You are finding a good strong uptake. It's not just you've rolled it out and no one's using it.
No, absolutely. We've got 5% of, sorry, the data traffic that's going across the Wi-Fi network is equivalent to 5% of the data traffic across the mobile network. So it's actually quite significant over the last 12 months.
And this is a free service, isn't it, for most telecom mobile subscribers? There's sort of a level of spend that you've got to have, and once you're above that, was it $29
exactly.
sort of accounts and up, get that free access?
Yeah, so it's available on $19 above and above on prepaid, and all of our postpaid customers, including both our consumer and business customers.
So it's very broad in terms of access.
It's very broad in terms of access. Non-telecom customers are also able to access the service at $9.95 per month, so it's by no means sort of close to non-telecom customers.
Right. But in both cases, you get that gig worth of data on through the Wi-Fi.
Absolutely,
yeah. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's been great. You know, and then the other business that I've been quite pleased about, and we'll probably have some more information over the next couple of weeks, is Curious, the big data business.
Yeah. Look forward to hearing some more on that next week. Now, a quick one on the Wi-Fi. How do you measure something like that you've put out? How do you measure whether that's successful? Because you probably can't tie back and say, look, we've won these new mobile customers because of Wi-Fi. Or maybe you can. Maybe you're surveying
a bit of work on that.
but it's hard to know which, you know, how effective I guess some of those initiatives are. How do you do that from a business perspective?
Some of the information's commercially sensitive, but we've put a reasonable amount of effort in over the last couple of weeks to really assess how much value it's adding, because you're right, on the surface of it is quite hard to measure. But we think we think we've got the analysis right. We've been talking to customers, we've been finding out how important they think Wi-Fi is relative to other buying factors like price or quality of network or speed and device choice and so on and so forth, and it's coming up surprisingly high up the list. We've also looked at sort of sample sets of customers with and without Wi-Fi, and looking at things about how much are they using their service, how long are they staying with us, and actually the customers that are using the Wi-Fi service are showing that actually they are using their services more, they're staying longer, and therefore.
I guess that is something you can tell. You can tell how sticky those particular customers are versus your average.
Absolutely. Right. So we've been really surprised actually about how well it's been perceived in the market and how much it's actually been used. It's blown away our expectations. So it's just given us the confidence really to do more. So we've got some interesting announcements over the next few weeks around further rollout. More and more coverage and more access points.
Great. I'll be interested to hear that. Now, usage of mobile networks is I guess a bit of a challenge for some of us, and we were chatting sort of before we started, and I hope you don't mind me sharing it. you talked about you're using sort of five to six gigs worth of data a month. Part of that is probably a reflection of the role that you're in, that you're trialing these things all the time. As you mentioned, you quite often do speed tests and so on. That uses up a bit of data and so on. But for the, for the average user, whether it's, whether we, just, have a consumer type account, or it's an account paid for by a business, getting access to that sort of level of data isn't the norm. The plans still make that reasonably expensive. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you pick that things are going to change over the next sort of 12 to 24 months in terms of making that sort of use more accessible, so we can be a lot more relaxed and just decide, hey, I want to do this and I'm going to do it without having to sort of think about, oh, what's that going to do to my data cap or to my bill and so on?
Oh, look, I think it's a really good question. Probably one of the lesser known sort of facts around 4G is not only gives you increased speed, but it also gives you a better cost structure for carrying increasing amounts of data. And so as we roll out the mobile network, as we roll out 4G coverage, and more of the data is being transported across 4G, over time our cost base to support that level of data declines.
Right.
Now the challenge is at the same time, though, the amount of data being used on a per user basis is growing at
just
a
keeps
at a
going up,
rate.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
So actually, the amount that customers are paying on a monthly basis is not actually decreasing because the cost is decreasing. The data explosion is actually offsetting that data growth. So we have a big challenge, and particularly in my previous role, which is how can we cope with ever increasing data volumes, but actually keep the cost base and the infrastructure base under control. That was probably what I was spending about a third or 40% of my time just trying to work out how we do it. But I think the short answer is, over time, the amount of data in the bundles at a given price point will increase, but it's just a matter of how quickly that changes. But it is changing. If you think about the amount of value available at a given price point this year versus last year or 2 years ago or 3 years ago, actually there's significantly more data available at a given price point.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, some of those very basic plans, like the $19 plans, they might not give you a huge amount of data, but compared to where we were sort of 3 or 4 years ago, that there's some pretty impressive little bundles and so on going on there. Okay, that's interesting. And Big Pipe, where does Big Pipe fit into the picture? Not one we've heard a huge amount about, but tell us about this new one.
Yeah, look, Big Pipe is not one of mine. It's a guy called Ollie Smith who's looking after that business. Look, it's fascinating from my perspective. Ollie and the guys have done a great job building what is a mini ISP. Super light, very, very low cost build, almost entirely self-service or online orientated. So super efficient, very, very slick sort of online sort of execution, no frills, really to hit, a super aggressive price point. We've decided to do away with bundles of data. So in effect, they're unlimited, but you buy based on the speed that you're interested in purchasing, from a slightly throttled speed up to sort of unrestricted. So we think we've sort of changed the model on its head a little bit, actually, and come up with something quite interesting. We're not marketing hard at the moment, but the numbers are sort of ticking along nicely, and we're in a phase of sort of bedding in, refining the processes, making sure actually the customers who are joining are super happy. We're getting a bit more confidence, and then we can put a bit more marketing in and look to sort of accelerate that business.
Right, yeah, because you've got your unlimited ADSL service, $79 a month, the VDSL service at $99 a month. Pretty competitive price points. Now, one thing I have heard, and I know that this sort of got brought up on the Geek Zone site, and I'm not sure if you can comment on it, but one of the highlights was that to go with VDSL through Big Pipe rather than the traditional method of putting in a sort of a ADSL or VDSL sort of splitter into the house, as it would just sort of be plug in and see how you go, would potentially would have the impact of you not getting as good a speed as you might do if that was put in, but it saves you a little bit of money. But the other flow-on effect is it might affect other customers on the same exchange because of the way that works with the noise across the line and so on. Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
And, I'm a mobile guy through and through, so I'll.
All right. Well, we'll let you off the hook on that one.
Refer to one of my colleagues.
Yeah, but we'd be quite keen to hear back on that, whether we've got the wrong end of the stick or whether there is potentially some impact on other customers. And I thought that it was. It's always interesting to hear of new businesses, new entities doing things a different way. But I was just curious: is that as bad as it sounded? Because the rest of the model for Big Pipe sounds really, exactly. really, really interesting.
But look, I can't confidently say one way or another. But sure, I would be surprised. I would be surprised if we've done something like that that's causing problems. But I'll take it away and I'll get Ollie and the guys to. to take a look.
Okay, no, that's good. Well, I think that that just about wraps it up. And unless you've got any other you know, gossip or secrets to tell us about what's happening in the telecom world, there, Ed.
No.
Nothing that won't get you into any trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think well, after we stop recording, we can probably discuss those.
Everything I do know probably will get me in trouble.
those other things. So, hey, it's been great to have you on the podcast, Ed. And now, you know, good to hear. You know, always good to hear when I guess a bigger business, and telecom really is at the big end of the scale as far as this country's concerned, but when a bigger business is light on its toes and thinking entrepreneurially and really looking at how it can serve its customers in a relevant way, and it seems to be happening more with bigger businesses than in the past, and I think, you know, the internet is a big part of that. So we'll certainly be keen to keep talking about the things that are coming out of digital ventures. Oh, now there was one area I did want to pick your brains about, actually, and again, it might not be your area, but you're probably in the loop, and this is around the digital wallet sort of side of things, and you know, we've tried out the various digital wallets across, you know, all the networks in some form over the last couple of years, starting with what 2Degrees were doing with Snapper, and then a trial from your end and something from Vodafone's end as well. How's that side coming along? There seem to have been some sort of changes in terms of the Android technology that these things sit on that potentially impacts it. I know there was talk with one of the trials last year, I think it was your one, that, you know, would probably be launched, there'd be, you know, some sort of digital wallet ability for average Joe customer to start making payments using their phone instead of their credit card to tap and pay, as it were. What's happening?
Look, good question, and actually I should have mentioned it earlier, given it's one of my projects.
But, it is? Okay.
Look, the TSM, Trusted Service Manager, which is the JV between ourselves, Paymark, Vodafone and 2Degrees, is trucking along really, really well.
Okay.
So we're just entering some testing phases at the moment, and we will have services in market later on this year. Those services will be offered by a number of the major existing retail banks today. So you will, by and large, as a customer of one of these banks, you'll be able to pay via your checking account or your credit card account.
Oh, so not just credit card account. This will be able to do an FPOS type equivalent.
Oh no!
As well.
So in the first wave, it will be Visa and MasterCard debit card,
right?
As opposed to FPOS. But we'd like to be able to get FPOS working across the services quickly as we can. So it's taken a little bit longer than we'd anticipated, just by nature of the number of different parties involved. If you think about the mobile operators, Paymark, and also the retail bank, so it's been a bit more complicated to deliver. But I think ultimately, where we're getting to is actually getting to a really great ecosystem of payments for Kiwis using their mobile, and they don't need to change the bank that they're with, which so very much a sort of user friendly service. And then thinking, you know, over the slightly longer term, actually around non payment services, so you know, transport, loyalty, and so on and so forth. I can really see a stage where actually your mobile wallet actually is, you know, very important, and you can get to start to think about, actually, I'll leave my wallet at home.
Well, it's certainly annoying at the moment, all the cards and things that you tend to have to carry around for various things, whether it's public transport or payments, or as you say, sort of the loyalty type cards at the supermarket or gas station and so on. So
exactly,
that would be very nice. Now, one of the technologies that has been a key part in this to date, certainly with the trials I've been involved in, is the near field communications capability. Which is in, you know, I think probably virtually every Android and Windows phone today. Yes. Apple, you know, haven't been playing today, in that space. How important is that technology to this at the moment? Is it an essential part to make it work in terms of the where things are at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. The NFC technology is an integral part in the overall service. There are a couple of reasons for that. Probably the number one reason is actually the payment terminals that are in retailers today.
Sure,
they're NFC capable. Any other technology solution would require a separate, a separate set of terminal equipment out there. Mm. The cost of doing that is just super, super high. Apple, the Apple equation is something that we're taking seriously. We know we need a solution for Apple. Because of their market share, we're hopeful that Apple will come around and ship with NFC, but there are no guarantees and no clear signals at all. So we're looking at some alternates to get Apple working within the wider ecosystem, so it can be part of it.
Okay. All right, we'll look forward to hearing a little bit more about that further down the track. I'm just looking at the time. I think we've broken our time limit.
I just wanted to sort of round things off with. Yep. You asked me if there was anything else to share, and I just wanted to get a sort of pitch in for Telecom that we've placed a sort of significant amount of effort and resource behind digital ventures to really sort of try and add a wave of innovation to complement the main brand and the main services that we have, and sort of increasingly now we really are hopeful that we've got a service offering for everyone across the portfolio. So the sort of key takeout for me.
Okay, well, good luck on that as you keep doing new things. Now, in terms of tracking you down or digital ventures down, what's the best place? Is there some social media channels? I think there's a Twitter account and a website and so on.
There's a Twitter account and Telecom Digital Ventures website, which is relatively sort of lightweight, so it just provides a bit of an overview of what we do. But the main way of getting hold of us would be via Twitter or via our email addresses or LinkedIn.
Yep. Okay. Hey, that's great. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Ed.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening in. We'll catch you on the next episode. See ya.